Hi folks, welcome to the second installment of House Therapy, Staying at Home Discovery. In this next edition, we will be exploring the bathroom and meeting the bathroom queen. But first, let us briefly recap what we have encountered so far. House therapy predicates that we have multiple subpersonalities and that these are most readily seen via the different rooms within our homes. The most important aspect of this self-help tool is to become aware of the various parts of ourself, the different voices making up you or me. Each room in your house or apartment offers evidence via its look and feel of a particular part of you ruling this domain. Too often we are reduced to thinking of ourselves as merely Joe or Joanne. Insert job here, insert age and gender here, insert racial profile here, etc. What about the real individual beneath these gross generalities? House therapy can get inside your head and get inside your heartfelt values. Let us now move to another room in your house or apartment, the bathroom. If the living room was home to our king self or dominant self, then the bathroom is the province of our queen. For it is our queen who is concerned with those things most keenly represented by the bathroom in our home. Our body, beauty, health, and mortality. These four riders in the storm are all inextricably linked with each other, and for our queen self are forces of nature which must be met, managed, and alas, ultimately surrendered to. We meet our body in the bathroom pretty regularly, I would hope and imagine. Our five senses engage with our physical self as we observe it, evaluate it, clean and repair it, and finally, hopefully, accept it. In the bathroom, we as queens of our senses are firmly focused on a layer of our identity. Through our bathroom mirror and through touch, we self-examine our physical selves. Our inner queen knows that the world judges us on our appearance and our beauty, for it is beauty which has remained unchallenged as the most desirable feminine quality throughout the ages. Even today, with all the knowledge and nuance inherent in 21st century living, what other characteristic shines out like beauty? A beautiful face, a beautiful body, beautiful eyes, a beautiful smile, beautiful hair, even a beautiful nose can inspire actions and life-changing events to occur. Great art most often concerns beautiful representations of the human form, and there are of course countless examples of this throughout the recorded millennia of our existence. Michelangelo's David, Leonardo's Mona Lisa, the sculptures of Praxiteles, and the too numerous classical statues of antiquity whose artists are largely unknown but are considered sublimely beautiful to behold. From the East, the stunning examples of carved wall reliefs on Buddhist temples and religious statues from Hindu, Sikh, and a myriad of other cultural examples, all reflecting a deep appreciation of the beauty and symmetry of the human form. For many people, and even for some great philosophers, beauty is God, or a clear sign of God's presence. We are often inspired in the presence of beauty, and many of us have devoted our lives to various manifestations of it. William Shakespeare, in his sonnet number 106, said it best. When in the chronicle of wasted time I see descriptions of the fairest whites, and beauty making beautiful old rhyme in praise of ladies dead and lovely knights, then in the blazon of sweet beauty's best, of hand, of foot, of lip, of eye, of brow, I see their antique pen would have expressed even such a beauty as you master now. So all their praises are but prophecies of this our time, all you prefiguring, and for they looked but with divining eyes, they had not skill enough your worth to sing. For we which now behold these present days have eyes to wonder but lack tongues to praise. This little poem basically says that though we have the intellectual skill and aesthetic abilities to describe and sing the praises of beauty, and have done so in our writings down through the ages, it is our visceral response to it which really tells the story. that the truly beautiful people in our lives engender a gut response within us, and we are moved beyond mere words, that all the great poems in history do not do justice to our feelings in the presence of true beauty. And of course, true beauty is, in the words of Lew Wallace, beauty is altogether in the eye of the beholder. So, beauty is very important to us and to our inner queen, absolutely vital. It has been said that perfect beauty is its own sole end. Which indicates that we do not, as a civilization, consider beauty as something that needs to be accompanied by any other attributes. It is enough, and sometimes more than enough, in itself. Plato spoke of the fact that we have a duty to live a beautiful life, that the gods require from us a sacred intention to be and behave as comely as we can. He stressed the correlation between the good life and the beautiful life, and that a life of leisure was more likely to contain beauty than a life lived working. The Greeks and Romans, of course, had slaves to do all the work for them and did not have to sully themselves with such base concerns. But I suppose similarly today we have white goods and computers to perform as our slaves. Beauty, according to Platonic ideals, was all about harmony and order, the symmetry of perfection and its inherent nobility, a duty to be beautiful. Now, I'm sure that would appeal to many bathroom queens. We look outward in our search for beauty in our lives. We are conditioned to look out and not within, to seek beauty and meaning in romantic love, art and nature. Beauty that inspires us to love, or perhaps to begin the journey to find our heart and meaning, to find meaning in that same quest for love. Or is there meaning in beauty itself? Much of our seeming obsession with appearing beautiful is, I think, the desire to be loved for who we are. Our skin makes us uniquely who we are and no other. To touch another's skin is an intimate act, and usually the preserve of mothers and lovers, skin to skin. The feel of your beloved skin is very important. It must feel right to touch for things to proceed from there. How one feels inside one's own skin is another way of conveying the emotional response to one's own existence. It is funny that we describe someone as skinny when they in fact have less skin than someone who is not so svelte. But perhaps we are referring to them having less fat beneath their skin. Still, we call someone a fatty when they have more fat, but linguistically ignore the need for the extra skin to stretch over that fat. Skinny latte for me, please. Skin is portrayed in myth as often about magical powers, like the dragon's scaly skin being impenetrable, or the healing powers of the snake shedding its skin as symbol of renewed life. Skins were our first clothing in ancient times to keep us warm and perhaps also to take on some of the properties of the slain animal. Bear skins, sheep skins, fox, wolf, mink, cat, dog, buffalo, rabbit, kangaroo. Shamans still today wear skins of their totemic animal when performing rituals. When the beautiful white swans descend down to water, they remove their feathered skins to become frolicking naked ladies. And if you can steal their skin, they will follow you home and be yours forever. According to the myth, that is. In house therapy, the bathroom is your body's garage or mechanical repair shop. It may not sound so glamorous, but the bathroom is about our health and our sense of service to our body, which is servant to our life force after all. This is the room with the big mirror that you often stand naked before, peering intently at that ever-changing visage in front of you. This is the room where you pluck, preen, and primp at hair and flesh. The room you wash and scrub every crack, crevice, and orifice. Have a look around at your bathroom now. Is it clean or could it do with a clean? Is it big or small? How much stuff is in or around the shower recess? How many bottles and tubes of indispensable goop are around the bathroom vanity? Lots of questions, and the answers will provide us with a great deal of insight. Insight into our health and our relationship with our body. The big bathroom with the big mirror might be saying to us that our body and our health is very important to us, and that we spend a good portion of our time appraising and maintaining both of these things. The small bathroom may therefore be telling us that we do not consider these manifest aspects of ourselves to be as important to us as to some. What is the right size bathroom? I think it depends on the individual, and if you honestly ask yourself, am I looking after my body properly, you will get your answer. The bathroom has its antecedents. The bathroom has its antecedents in the spas of antiquity, where the healing processes are mentioned in the Ayurveda, the Sanskrit medical text, which appeared in 568 BC. Here it lists the vital importance of sweating and 13 approaches that can be taken to achieve this cleansing state. The baths or thermae of ancient Rome are well known, and it is interesting to note how important they were to this civilization. I have visited the Roman baths at the eponymously named southwestern city of England, Bath. This is a very ancient site, as the sulphur springs themselves had been a religious site for the early Iron Age Britons prior to the Roman colonization around the 1st century AD. Indeed, it has probably been a sacred site since the beginning of time. As it is common to many early societies to worship at hot springs as a way of being closer to the perceived heart of the earth, I found it to be a site rich in history, with the steam rising above the greenish water amid the sulphuric smells and the ancient carved stone. One could almost be back there 2 millennia ago. Bathing rituals in Rome and in the earlier Hellenistic civilization were considered a daily part of life and were not just to get clean. The communal aspect of their bathing rituals cannot be underestimated. It is perhaps a healthier pursuit to involve others in the bathing ritual, as in the communal spa or sauna, because an independent or objective view of the state of our body can be more profound. I suppose today our partners, and in particular our wives or girlfriends, play this role, as it is often women who are more realistically honest about matters of physical health than menfolk. Today, through our desire for individual physical privacy, it is easier to maintain hidden levels of disease and poor health than it would have been within these civilizations. The state of your health within these communities belonged more to the group than to just the individual. Even before this, I would posit that the true origins of the bathroom is the waterhole where we gathered as animals to drink and refresh ourselves. So our bathroom is psychologically linked to a place of physical replenishment and nurture. Well, bathroom queen, how big is that mirror in your bathroom? How many mirrors are there in your temple of health and beauty? How well lit is your bathroom? Are there windows in your queenly chamber, and how large are they? What do these things say to you about yourself? How important is the maintenance of your health and beauty to you? The bathroom is the barometer of how we value the upkeep of our body's health. Those neglected, chipped and stained bathroom tiles are telling us that we may be ignoring potential physical ruin, and often in circumstances like this we have trained ourselves not to look, and to avoid seeing what is right before our eyes. This habit can propel us towards disease and decay. What colour is your bathroom? Looking closer now, we can see how we feel about our own bodies. Are we comfortable with how we look and the state of our physical selves? The colour of our bathroom walls can indicate how we feel about our relationship with our body. White and more neutral coloured walls usually suggests a more functional attitude to this relationship, and colder colours, like some shades of blue, can reflect a more clinical relationship. Warmer and more dramatic colours in the bathroom speak of more feeling for the body and its importance to our health. Interestingly, as I'm sure you are aware, most bathrooms are white or something along those clean, clear, clinical lines. Do we have cultural expectations like taboos regarding our bathrooms and what they should look like? I think that we clearly do, and it has in part been fed in recent times by the power and might of the advertising industry, funneling the American-led obsession with making money through sales and cleaning products. TV is awash with images of sparkling white bathroom tiles and toilet rims, and worried women's faces indicating their apparent concern with what other women will think about the state of cleanliness of their bathroom facilities. This is all about selling lots of chemical cleansing agents to the general public, and is just another example of the advertising industry and capitalism exploiting fears and perceived anxieties within the community. Generations of wealthy Westerners have grown up with these fears being fanned by continual exposure to images of very white bathrooms and or the social disgrace of not having a visually enhanced very white bathroom. We are now at the point where some scientists and doctors are becoming concerned at the lack of natural dirt and bacteria in our immediate environments, and this could be one of the reasons why we are now experiencing so many chronic intolerances and conditions like asthma and celiac disease, to name just two. Of course, now, in the time of COVID-19 and the coronavirus global pandemic, we are madly spraying every surface with bleach and cleansing agents, and have developed critical hand protocols involving hand washing and hand sanitizer. These, of course, are necessary things for a necessary health crisis. Does your bathroom have a bath and shower, or just a bath, or just a shower? How important is a bath to you or not? A bathroom which has no bath and just a shower may indicate that the time this individual spends looking after his or her body is kept to a minimum. A bath suggests a more languid approach to the needs of the body, and that our bodies need more than just a wash and the occasional scrub. How many towel racks or hooks in your bathroom? The taps on the shower, bath and basin, are they beautiful? I think that the recent rise in bigger and more beautiful bathrooms in the West is not just simply about greater prosperity. It is also about how much more we now value our bodies and general health. My parents' generation did not actively construct a bathroom to be a place of retreat and recuperation. Bathrooms were for far more prosaic reasons and needs in the suburbs where I grew up in the 1970s. Is your bathroom merely functional? Is it beautiful or falling apart? The incredible, beautiful bathroom which is poorly maintained, the bathroom of five-star hotel room proportions, which is stained and smeared with splashes of this and that, with wet towels and mats clogging up the space and endless plastic bottles of various lotions lying about just everywhere. Well, this is often narcissism in its nascent form. Vanity can overextend its usefulness beyond mere health of the body and become like an all-consuming virus, devouring everything and everyone in its way. This is the bathroom princess or prince who spends a good deal of their waking life ensconced in the steaming zone of porcelain and tile. The Austrian father of modern psychiatry, Sigmund Freud, coined the term narcissism, which in part refers to excessive self-love to the exclusion of being able to love another. Basing the name on the ancient Greek myth of Narcissus, who was a beautiful boy who, whilst wandering in the forest, came upon his own reflection in a pool for the first time. In the story, the nymph Echo has been punished by the goddess Hera for gossiping and was cursed to forever have the last word. Echo had seen Narcissus walking through the forest and was attracted enough to want to talk with him. However, due to the curse, she was unable to initiate a dialogue. When Narcissus became thirsty and stopped to take a drink, he saw his reflection in the water and he fell in love with his own visage. Echo, who had been following him, began repeating the last thing he said. Not comprehending the nature of reflections, Narcissus thought his reflection was speaking to him, and thus was engaged, and his fate was sealed. Unable to consummate his love, Narcissus pined away at the pool, and from his death there grew a flower that now bears his name, the Narcissus. So the bathroom can be a place of narcissistic worship, a temple to our own reflection, containing ointments and balms with which to massage and polish our own visage. I would speculate that many people spend a good deal of time in front of that bathroom mirror, often in silent contemplation at their appearance, whether wishing to appear younger, slimmer, or more beautiful. And this then inspiring conscious thoughts of just who we are, and who we have been. Some say that there is a level of healthy narcissism, and perhaps this reflective contemplation is that. For many of us in our non-contemplative lives, this may indeed be our only regular time we spend with ourselves in a semi-meditative state, looking into the mirror as the observer, and thinking about ourselves, contemplating our own mortality. As an exercise, why not try having a notebook next to you in the bathroom, somewhere a little protected from the splashes, but close enough at hand, and jotting down some of the thoughts you have during your daily pilgrimage at the Temple of Narcissus. See perhaps if you are a little hard on yourself about how you look and whether your expectations are somewhat unrealistic in their defiance of gravity. One of the secrets to a happy life is developing an acceptance of who we really are and moving our core values from what other people think to what we really think. In fact, it is usually what we think other people think, and that is often not what they are thinking at all. Often the other doesn't really care that much about our particular physical details, and it is our own obsession tormenting us. Spend a few reflective moments asking yourself whether it is really worth giving yourself such a hard time over what you look like, and whether life would be better spent loving and accepting yourself for who you are. When you bring your energy to the isness of things, you become stronger and more empowered in your life. It is like aligning the forces in your universe instead of having your self-esteem in conflict with your nature, desires, likes, and loves. All yourselves are then all on the same team, and wow, you can suddenly achieve a whole lot more. You get happy too. A clean bathroom is generally a good sign about our relationship with our health. Obviously, a fanatical attitude towards bathroom cleanliness says something else again about fear of death and the desperate desire to stay in control. I think Sigmund Freud spoke about the act of cleaning as a sublimation of the sexual act, all that scrubbing and polishing, all those viscous fluids. Attitudes to cleanliness do play a big part in our relationship to our sexuality, and it is in the bathroom where this is most prominently displayed, although cleaning the fridge and the nude at 3 a.m. in the morning can be pretty sexy too. Our relationship with our own bodies defines our relationship to our sexuality, whether it is a celebration of love or something darker. If you hate your own self-image and body, then it is much more difficult to enjoy sex without the whips and chains anyway. So our bathroom represents our physical self and our connection to the body. Do you nurture your physical self, and do you look after your body? Do you have a realistic and honest relationship with your body based on who you are rather than who you want to be? Do you love yourself and what you look like? Many of us have a split relationship with ourselves, appreciating some parts and despising others. Indeed, we may say we like and dislike particular bits of our body. Oh, I hate my thighs, is a common refrain. Or, I like my breasts, but I hate my bum. Splitting our identity into pieces of which we reject this and that section of our human form is not the way to happiness and genuine self-acceptance and self-love. What it is saying is that a part of your consciousness and a dominant sub-personality voice is rejecting a valid aspect of who you are in your entirety. Learning to love who we are is a journey, and sometimes a long journey, but the body in the mirror deserves your love and support. I was angry with my friend, I told my wrath did end. I was angry with my foe, I told it not, my wrath did grow. And I watered it in fears, night and morning, with my tears, and I sunned it with smiles and with soft deceitful wiles. And it grew both day and night, till it bore an apple bright, and my foe beheld it shine, and he knew that it was mine. And into my garden stole, when the night had veiled the pole, in the morning glad I see my foe outstretched beneath the tree. This poem is called A Poison Tree by William Blake. This poem, as many of you may know, is all about honesty and truthful communication in relationships, and our relationship with ourselves is possibly our most important relationship. If we lie to ourselves and do not openly show our vulnerabilities, we risk developing complexes and diseases like the poisonous fruit in Blake's poem. The fact that we have several subpersonalities or voices within us has been shown here in the principles of house therapy. And as with all organizations and teams, honesty is always the best policy. If we can learn to share, make space, and allow all our voices to be heard, all the animals in the zoo, we will be happier and more fulfilled individuals. Next time that you feel conflicted within, take the time for an internal dialogue. Listen to your internal voices and perhaps use the various rooms inside your home to help bring them out. I will expand on this idea more fully a bit further down the track. Our bathroom queen is ultimately faced with her own immortality. In the mirror each day, and with each passing year, our aging body's visage is reflected back to us. It is here in the bathroom that we often come to terms with the facts of living and dying. For we cannot avoid this reality forever. The cyclical nature of existence is there plain to see in our wrinkled skin, grey hairs and disappearing hair, cloudy eyes, mottled complexion, and a host of other natural decaying signs of our impending mortality. Now, we may have fought the good fight and held back the years for longer than was expected in our parents' time, but eventually we must all surrender. So the aging queen lives inside us all, and her crone-like features peep out at us from that bathroom mirror every now and then. A quickly plucked grey hair, a furiously massaged wrinkle or crease, and the use of a scientifically proven treatment of collagen extracted from the skin of a dead baby seal are all acts performed by the bathroom queen in her battle with the Grim Reaper. Learn to love and appreciate the wisdom she can bring at the appropriate times, and don't be forever frightened of the natural unfolding and unravelling of life. When the time is right, and I think each individual knows when that is, you can, by going with the flow and not fighting time endlessly, release a great deal of energy. This energy, which has been tightly bound up with that battle, can provide you with an immense sense of relief, and this can be an incredibly healing energy, both for you and others within your circle of life. You can become the elder of your tribe, the wise earth mother, emanating that glow of acceptance within the web of life. We spend a great deal of our time doing things without any real reflection upon what we are doing. We are intrinsically caught up in the drama of everyday activity, and this often prevents us from pausing and having a good look around at where we currently find ourselves, which is why it is usually only at times of crisis, like the crisis we're in now with the COVID-19 coronavirus global pandemic, that reassessments about our lives are made. In the meantime, we are often all at sea and lacking a crystal ball or insight into our situation. It is not that the process involved in house therapy is particularly obtuse, but rather that we are culturally blind to any real analysis of our own behavior. If it is not broken, why bother fixing it or even looking into it? This is our readily expressed cultural attitude to self-awareness in the West. This also explains why we are so skeptical about the different philosophical approaches that come out of the East. We are culturally averse to accepting viewpoints like those that have emerged from Taoism, Zen, Buddhism, and other more reflective pathways through life. If we cannot immediately join all the dots, then we disparage it as unscientific. Really, the truth and evidence of who and what we are is all around us and right in front of us. You just need to take the time to have a look. E.M. Gombrich said, "Perception, it has recently been said, may be regarded as primarily the modification of an anticipation. It is always an active process, conditioned by our expectations and adapted to situations. Instead of talking of seeing and knowing, we might do a little better to talk of seeing and noticing. We notice only when we look for something, and we look when our attention is aroused by some disequilibrium, a difference between our expectation and the incoming message. We cannot take in all we see in a room, but we notice if something has changed. We influence everything we come into contact with. In fact, according to the latest research in physics, quantum theory, these things may or may not exist without our participation or observance. Science, in the most cutting-edge realms, now shows us that our very own consciousness plays a direct part in the existence of our universe. Pretty awe-inspiring stuff, really. We are no longer seen as mere spectators in the cosmos, but rather our very presence has an impact on all life and matter around us. It takes a long time for these massive changes in collective human consciousness to filter through to us or to all of us. And the revolutionary illumination provided by quantum mechanics began about 100 plus years ago. People like Albert Einstein, Werner Heisenberg, and Niels Bohr made these theoretical discoveries about the nature of life on the subatomic plane at the beginning of the 20th century. Basically, they discovered that the rules which govern the macro universe, the bigger things like apples and planets, did not apply to the smallest known particles which make up the fabric of all matter or of everything. So the rules of the known game had changed, and for a long time nobody was very sure about a lot of things. They were clear about the fact that these subatomic particles or waves were affected by those who were observing them, and that matter was no longer indifferent to our consciousness of it. Physicist E. H. Walker said, "Consciousness may be associated with all quantum mechanical processes, since everything that occurs is ultimately the result of one or more quantum mechanical events. The universe is inhabited by an almost unlimited number of rather discrete, conscious, usually non-thinking entities that are responsible for the detailed working of the universe." Albert Einstein said, "Physical concepts are free creations of the human mind, uniquely determined by the external world. In our endeavor to understand reality, we are somewhat like a man trying to understand the mechanism of a closed watch. He sees the face and the moving hands, even hears its ticking, but he has no way of opening the case. If he is ingenious, he may form some picture of a mechanism which could be responsible for all the things he observes, but he may never be quite sure his picture is the only one which could explain his observations. He will never be able to compare his picture with the real mechanism, and he cannot even imagine the possibility of the meaning of such a comparison." This highlights another approach that we often take as human beings in our search for understanding. That is to create models of things. For instance, the computer can be seen as a model or a working paradigm of our own brains. The computer is not as nearly sophisticated as our real brains, but it is the most complex thing we have come up with so far. In our language today, with the modern lexicon, we have begun using expressions and terms like default position, hard drive, download, key in, all used as metaphors to describe aspects of life not directly related to the computer, but usually about examples of human behavior and thought, using the computer and its function as a model for our own complex selves. Earlier models we used to understand ourselves with were the steam and combustion engines during the time of the Industrial Revolution. And, of course, another archetypal model is the home or house. Here we have a structure divided up into functional parts or rooms, and each room has a definite set of things with which to provide us with. We build mental models that represent significant aspects of our physical and social world, and we manipulate elements of those models when we think, plan, and try to explain events of that world. The ability to construct and manipulate models of reality provides humans with our distinctive adaptive advantage. It must be considered one of the crowning achievements of the human intellect. These models offer us the opportunity to temporarily isolate a particular aspect of ourselves or the world and bring awareness to it. And if this behavior or characteristic is causing us some level of concern for whatever reason, then we have the chance to understand it. The word understand comes from the root words to stand under, which means in effect that we give this quality permission to be and to express itself unhindered by our controlling censorious self. It is like you are standing under a particular god or king as loyal subject, and this king is representing a particular behavior in your life. Basically, once you say that you understand something, you then stop rejecting whatever it is and accept it into your life. Have you had the experience of having some aspect of human behavior explained to you, either directly or more commonly through reading a self-help book, and then seeing the behavior in yourself and accepting the explanation proffered? Would you agree that there is usually an accompanying feeling of relief in this acceptance and understanding, which often then leads to a freer expression of the behavior and a concomitant awareness that it is no longer such a problem? Sometimes the behavior actually disappears as it has been heard and understood. In my Father's house are many mansions. If not, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you. This is a line from the King James Version of the Bible in John 14:2. Our homes serve a profound psychological purpose within our lives, reflecting who we are through our tastes and values expressed in the paint, plaster, bricks and mortar, which make up our houses and apartments. When we are very old and or terminally sick, we are often encouraged and or forced to leave our homes and move to a transitional place, like a retirement village or hospice. Here, our grip on life is often not so strong, and the walls and things around us are usually not as informed by our presence. Our connection with who we are may have coalesced into a few framed photographs on a shelf beside our bed. You can see the signs that the souls of these people are being called away from their lives, and that the end of their days is getting nearer. Our connection to our homes is a visible marker of our state of buoyancy and mortality. The first known houses were houses of the gods. The Egyptian temple was more than a physical structure for pious devotion. It was an image of the universe that had acted as an instrument to enable the world to order its parts in harmony and recreate its elements by the mystery of resurrection. Through it, people could reframe their views on the world, its grand and imposing presence, even when only viewed from the exterior, expanded the consciousness of one's own life, petty and inconsequential, beyond the personal, into the cosmic scheme. For many millennia, the largest building in just about every village, town, or community was a building to house the dead, and thus the gods. We do not think anything of this today, as we have all grown up with the existence of churches and temples, and think them ordinary. But if you stand back from the known reality and ask yourself, is it natural to create palaces for dead kings and ethereal presences, whilst at the same time having the majority of the population living in hovels or structures of a very sparse and basic nature? It is rather uniquely human, I would posit, and not something occurring in the animal world, or should I say those other animal worlds. Today we are building houses, the equivalent of the palaces of yesteryear, and it is worth considering the possibility that today we have become gods living inside our own temples. We would definitely appear so to those who lived a few millennia ago, with all our wealth and with such technological wonders at our fingertips. If God does not live up there in the sky anymore, and with many of us no longer worshipping him or her in churches and temples around town, perhaps we now commune with the gods in our own homes, in our bathrooms. Why else have we erected these, in many cases, enormous temple-like houses? We must be the kings and queens, high priests and priestesses, whom inhabit these houses of God, and maybe it is time to recognize and explore that possibility. I'd like to spend the last few minutes talking about haunted houses. It can be an interesting process to ask yourself who, apart from the living, lives in your house or home. Grab a pen and paper and sit in your living room and let your mind wander through the realms of memory inspired by the space you sit in and jot down who comes to mind. These people might be past lovers, friends or family, still alive or now dead. But something in the room links you to these people and their memories, your very own haunted house, but haunted in a natural kind of way. Where it may be a couch or chair, cushion or painting on the wall that reminds you of them and what they meant to you. Photographs, of course, are obvious ghost traps, and these images will send you off on those memory loops, complete with feelings that make you feel good and bad. You may become aware that you spend a great deal of time with ghosts, sitting in your room and staring at those reminders of people who are no longer there. Sometimes this can be a lot more satisfying than watching TV. And allowing yourself to ruminate, ruminate. Interesting word correlation there. Our emotional centers often spend a great deal more time going over experiences from our past and processing these feelings by rerunning snippets and versions of the memories. The rooms in our homes and the furniture within these rooms become visual triggers for these neural sorting processes. It might be the color of a particular cushion or the memory of a couch or rug where you once made love, or it might be a dent in a picture frame which fell to the floor when he or she slammed that last door on their way out of your life, or it may be something even sadder of a terminal nature. I think that this is what haunted houses really are. They are haunted by our memories of particular poignant past events and the ghosts of the people we once loved. Rediscovering these shades and ghosts, or perhaps becoming aware of just how often you think about them, can be the first step in liberating yourself and moving on, if it has all gone on for too long. How many ghosts have you found inhabiting your living room? If you are sensing that you have become a little trapped in their presence inside your living room or bedroom or bathroom or special room in your home, consider moving them out by removing those talismans, those items of furniture and decor linking you to those memories, either by permanent measures or just by shifting them into a less visited space or room within your home. This will be like reordering their place inside you by reordering their reminders out of your main living space and perhaps creating a shrine to their memory in a room elsewhere. If you want to move on with your life and maybe attract new energies into your existence, then taking control of your main living space and thus your dominant self will host this process. We now know that ghosts appear real because of mistakes made in the brain. Some are trivial, everyday mistakes, and others arise from abnormalities in dreaming sleep. A few are stirred up by small epileptic seizures or the pathological processes seen in psychosis. We call them hallucinations. They involve false sounds, more often than false sights. The people and pets that they feature are often scrambled a bit, just as they are in the jumble of nighttime dreams. Remember that what you see under normal circumstances owes its stability to a mental model that you construct. Your eyes are actually darting all over, producing a retinal image of the scenes as jerky as an amateur video, and some of what you thought you saw was instead filled in from memory. In a hallucination, this mental model is carried to an extreme. Memories stored inside your brain are interpreted as current sensory input. Sometimes this happens when you are struggling to wake up, when the paralysis of the muscles during dreaming sleep hasn't worn off as fast as usual. Dream elements appear superimposed on the image of real people walking around the bedroom. Or you might hear a dead relative speak to you with a familiar phrase. Half the brain is awake and the rest is still dreaming away. With any luck, you realize this and don't try to place a more exotic construction on it. Each of us, after all, experiences nightly the symptoms of dementia, delusions, and hallucinations in the course of our dreaming sleep. We're accustomed to discounting such things. William H. Calvin from How Our Brains Think. I think that this is what haunted houses really are. They are haunted by our memories of particularly poignant past events and the ghosts of the people we once loved. Remember that love is a verb, a doing word? And if those people are now departed for whatever reason, where does that love action, that loving go now? How does it express itself in your life at the moment? If love is a form of energy that we give with, and if it is rattling around inside your home, bouncing off walls, pictures, mementos, and favorite rugs, then perhaps it is time to let it out. Time to give love to others and to discover the new in whatever form it may take. It may be giving to those less fortunate than yourself to begin with, tea and sympathy, charitable acts perhaps. Starting with small steps for your heart is sometimes good. And if you seek a bigger kind of love, then it may come in time, when your heart is ready for it. For never touch of gladness stirs my heart, but timorously beginning to rejoice, like a blind Arab that from sleep doth start. In lonesome tent I listen for thy voice. Beloved, 'tis not thine, thou art not there. Then melts the bubble into idle air, and wishing without hope, I restlessly despair. Some Coleridge, The Blossoming of the Solitary Date, stanza 4. So, to review what we have covered so far, we have met the bathroom queen. We have discussed beauty and its importance within our cultural identity. We have looked into health and physical repair in our bathrooms, touched on the spas of antiquity, the modern bathroom's antecedents. We have observed and analysed your bathroom and its contents. We've looked at cleaning and capitalism, the big sell. Also narcissism, obsessive, superficial self-love. Most importantly, telling yourself the truth about your state of health, which is what house therapy really says, what the bathroom is all about. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of House Therapy, Discovering Yourself at Home, and that you will tune in for our next episode, which will be coming out next week. Goodbye, and thank you very much.